This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربكم ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's president says the United States is in decline and its threats do not sway independent nations. Russia and Belarus are preparing to hold joint military drills early next year as tensions peak over NATO's eastward expansion. Also coming up, the US is facing a surge in Omicron with a 7-day average of nearly 270,000 cases. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi says the US threats and sanctions can no longer sway independent nations as American power is in decline. Raisi has made the remarks during a phone call with the Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega. The Iranian president says Washington cannot impose its wishes on Tehran and Managua because both countries rely on their people's votes and support. He also says the two nations have always withstood the excessive demands of hegemonic powers. For his part, Ortega has highlighted Iran and Nicaragua's fight against U.S. imperialism. A senior Iranian official says the U.S. was not the only country that was involved in the assassination of top Iranian commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Secretary General of Iran's Human Rights Office, Kazim Gharib-Abadi, says the legal proceedings on the case are underway in Iran as well as in Iraq, where the attack took place. He says a joint committee of Iranian and Iraqi judiciary members has been formed and is expected to present their findings soon to lay the ground for a criminal investigation. Gharib-Abadi says Iran is also pursuing the assassination case through international and human rights organizations at the same time. Lieutenant General Soleimani was killed in a U.S. drone strike near Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020. Now, Iran strongly slams the holding of a recent Israeli cabinet meeting in Syria's occupied Golan Heights, calling it a provocative act. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says based on several UN resolutions, the Golan Heights are an inseparable part of the Syrian Arab Republic. Khatibzadeh stresses that Israel's settlement expansion in the Golan cannot change the facts, adding that settlers will not be able to reside in the area forever. Israel has announced plans to double the number of its settlers in the occupied Golan. Syria has condemned the move as a dangerous and unprecedented escalation.
Israel captured Syria's Golan Heights in the closing stages of the regime's 1967 war on Arab nations and annexed the occupied territory in 1981 in a move that was not recognized by the international community. The UN Security Council, in its resolution 497, adopted unanimously in December 1981, declared the Israeli decision null and void and without international legal effect. Nonetheless, former U.S. President Donald Trump granted U.S. recognition to Israel's sovereignty over the Syrian territory in 2019. The administration of current President Joe Biden, which remains critical of its predecessor for its unilateral approaches, has not taken any move to reverse the decision. Amid the U.S. blind support, the Israeli premier unveiled a plan on Sunday to double the regime's settler population in the occupied Golan Heights from the current 25,000 with a multi-million dollar plan. The land is rich in water sources. Naftali Bennett said the move has been prompted by the Trump administration's recognition of Israeli sovereignty over the Golan and the Biden administration's indication that it will not soon challenge that decision. Syria has reacted to Israel's decision to expand the number of Jewish settlers in the occupied Golan Heights, calling it a dangerous and unprecedented escalation and a war crime.
Israel continues with its settlement policy and systematic violations, which are war crimes. The Golan Heights is an integral part of Syrian soil, and we will work to return it in full to the homeland by any means permitted by international law.
In the light of the U.S. backing, Israel has also been expanding its settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, which are illegal under international law. Palestinians believe the U.S. brokered normalization deals between Israel and some Arab states have emboldened the regime to press ahead with its expansionist agenda and land grab policies. But such expansionist policies are just the tip of the iceberg, as acts of violence by Israeli forces and settlers have intensified against Palestinians in the West Bank. That alongside frequent shelling and air raids against the besieged Gaza Strip. The international community has stopped short of taking any practical action in the face of Israel's seizure of Syria's Golan Heights, the occupation of the West Bank, and atrocities against Palestinians as a whole. Israel's aggressive policies will not change the truth that the Golan remains part of Syria, but its fresh expansionist move will create further tensions in a region that has been paying the price of Tel Aviv's destabilization activities.
Russian President Vladimir Putin says his country and Belarus will hold joint military drills on Belarusian territory in February or March 2022. Putin made the announcement at a meeting with Belarusian leader Alexander Lukashenko in St. Petersburg. This comes amid unprecedented tensions between Moscow and the West over Ukraine, which borders both Russia and Belarus. Meanwhile, U.S. President Joe Biden and Putin have scheduled to have a phone call on Thursday. A senior U.S. official said Biden will offer Putin a, quote, diplomatic path out of tensions around Ukraine, but remains concerned by Russian troop movements. The U.S.-led NATO has stepped up anti-Russia rhetoric, claiming that Moscow is preparing to invade Ukraine. Moscow denies the allegations. Scott Bennett is a former psychological warfare officer and political commentator and joins us now live out of San Francisco. Scott, welcome. It's good to see you. You know, if NATO is really concerned about a Russian military build-up inside its own borders, or in this case, joint military drills with Belarus, why would NATO expand its forces towards eastward, towards Russian borders? Is that not a military provocation and escalation that warrants Russia to be prepared to defend its own territory?
Well, it certainly is. And the NATO personalities and the U.S. personalities are doing this for their own showmanship. They're doing it for relevance. They're doing it almost like a dramatic theatrical play, whereas the Russians are doing it out of real life necessity and are deadly serious about the potential weaponry being transferred into areas very close to their borders. So the Russian motivation is entirely different than the NATO and Western motivation, and that's very dangerous. And the NATO forces and the U.S. forces don't seem to really understand that Russia and President Putin are probably more upset and angry than they've ever been in the last 30 years. This is really the climax of a 30-year slow war against Russia, from Bosnia-Herzegovina, Yugoslavia, the encroachment against Russia's borders, the capturing of satellite countries, and violating the original promises and agreements, the ostracization of Russia, the rejection of Yeltsin and Russia's desire to become really more close with European unity. This has been a long time coming, and it really is on a level that I've never encountered before. So I think the West has totally miscalculated this. I think Russia realizes that Biden has no cards to play whatsoever, neither does NATO, because no European person wants a war with Russia. There's no benefit to any European person. The only people that benefit are the generals and the politicians that play a part in this. And they don't seem to remember that Russia's history over 1,000 years has involved a shifting of borders from various invasions from Poland, Turkey, Georgia, France, Germany. Russia has been playing for over 1,000 years this game of constant shifts, and it's a very complicated and long history, longer than the United States has ever existed. So I think this is a game that Biden is playing that Russia will win. And I would also say Iran should stand very solidly and boldly on the side of Russia, not wanting war, but saying as a background voice, do you not hear and understand, European people and nations, that your leaders are leading you to war and they don't have your best interests? And what they're trying to do to Russia, they're also trying to do to Iran, and Israel is behind a lot of that. So there has to be a really joint effort for a peaceful communications and a desire for tamping down this Western military hysteria and fever.
Scott, thank you very much indeed for your thoughts and your time. Scott Bennett there, former psychological warfare officer, joining us out of San Francisco. Moving on now, Argentina's daily COVID infections soaring to a new record, with health officials saying the Omicron variant is spreading rapidly around the nation. There have been more than 42,000 new cases in 24 hours, but the deaths remain low. 80% of the population is fully vaccinated, and Argentina is already rolling out booster shots. The country started easing its COVID restrictions 2 months ago. Also, neighboring Bolivia is reporting around 5,000 new cases, the highest single day tally still. The nation has detected no cases of Omicron so far. Meantime, anti-vaccination groups have marched in La Paz and another Bolivian city to protest mask wearing and vaccine passports. South America is now the world leader in vaccinations, but it has also seen some of the worst death tolls from the virus. Staying with coronavirus news, the new wave of the pandemic driven by the Omicron variant is raging in the United States, setting a record high in daily cases. According to data from Johns Hopkins University, the 7-day average of new cases has topped 265,000. The last time the number of cases hit a peak was in January. Government data showed that around 60% of infections have been caused by the Omicron strain. Michigan, Vermont, Maine and New Hampshire are the hardest hit states. The outbreaks have also created long lines at testing sites and caused a shortage of home kits. The US is the world's worst hit nation by COVID-19, both in terms of deaths and infections. 2021 was an eventful year for the US and Canada. This report takes a closer look at some of the major occurrences that made the headlines in the two biggest countries in the Western Hemisphere.
The United States in 2021.
Chaos broke out very early in 2021 in the United States. Less than a week into the new year, the world was shocked by footage showing thousands of Americans besieging and storming the Capitol building in the heart of Washington, D.C. The reason? They wanted to stop the certification of Joe Biden's victory in the presidential election. Many called it an insurrection. Rarely has the world witnessed with such clarity the inherent division in the U.S. political system. What may previously have been a crack in the country's democracy now turned into a wide chasm. On January 13th, a week after the riots, Donald Trump became the first sitting U.S. president to be impeached twice. The House of Representatives began the trial of the controversial figure after he adamantly refused to concede election defeat and incited his fan to march on the Capitol and, quote, stop the steal. However, in yet another sign of the failure of the political duopoly, the Republican-held Senate did not find Trump guilty. Just like the first impeachment proceeding against him on charges of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. On January 20th, Biden took office. The veteran Democrat, while on the campaign trail, had tried his best to demonize the incumbent leader and distance himself from his policies. By taking his place at the Oval Office, Biden towed Trump's line on multiple fronts. The Biden administration obediently followed its predecessor's maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Despite numerous pledges, it refused to stop supporting Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen. Biden even blatantly backtracked on his promise to change the U.S. approach towards migrants. People trying to cross into the U.S. faced even more hardship, and those who could get through suffered severe abuse. But that's not all. Getting COVID-19 under control was another pledge that Biden had made. But after almost a year in office, the U.S. remains on top in terms of both infections and death rates. In late December, COVID fatalities reached more than 800,000, but many Americans remained reluctant to get vaccinated as they do not trust their government. During the current administration, rampant gun violence was a major issue for many Americans. Moreover, little has been done to stop global warming, even though the U.S. rejoined the Paris Climate Accord, which Trump had quit. 2021 has not been a good year for civil rights either. Racial equality remains a distant dream for African Americans, despite a long jail term given to Derek Chauvin, a white officer who had violently killed a black man in the previous year. In September, bipartisan negotiations over a police reform bill collapsed. For now, it seems that minorities will still have to live in fear of police brutality.
Canada in 2021.
The United States' northern neighbor, Canada, also experienced a chaotic 2021. In May and June, authorities found nearly 1,200 bodies of Indigenous children buried in unmarked mass graves. The grim discovery refreshed the historical plight of the First Nation Canadians. The children of these communities were forcibly separated from their families during the 19th and 20th centuries and taken to infamous residential church schools where many of them suffered abuse and torture and many others went missing. The scandal rocked Canada's self-proclaimed image of human rights defender. A cultural genocide was what an investigative commission concluded, saying thousands had died and many were subjected to physical and sexual abuse at church-run schools in Canada. In 2021, Canada also saw continued protests calling for justice for thousands of missing or murdered Indigenous women. According to the Native Women's Association of Canada, Indigenous women are three times more likely to experience violence during the course of their life than their non-native counterparts. The damning figure is a clear sign of the deep-rooted colonialism worsened by state inaction. The country also experienced an unprecedented heat wave in the past year, which led to the death of hundreds of people. Wildfires burned for months throughout much of Canada, making it the third worst wildfire season on record. Flooding was another natural disaster that prompted authorities in the Canadian Pacific Coast province of British Columbia to declare a state of emergency in November.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Day of Insight and Allegiance with Leader. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. On the 9th of the Iranian month of Day 1388, corresponding with December 30, 2009, the Iranian nation created a glorious epic, a multi-million strong epic in support of the ideals of the Islamic Revolution and the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. This great day was the day of re-allegiance of the Ummah with the leader, and it remained in the book of the revolution like a golden page. This day has been named as the day of insight and allegiance with leader. Ayatollah Khamenei said on this day, "If this nation prostrates hundreds of times as a sign of gratitude for the bounty of this day, still it won't be enough." On such a day, millions of the Iranian people poured to the streets of Tehran and other cities in a spontaneous move to demonstrate their support for the leader, the Islamic Revolution, and their religious beliefs. After the presidential election in 2009 in Iran, the failed candidate tried to suggest that the election had been rigged and he was the president. It is astounding that even before counting the votes, he announced his victory at the ballot box, saying that the election would have no winner except him. This pre-planned scenario caused unrest in big cities, especially Tehran, and little by little resulted in vandalistic street riots, which ripped through different parts of the capital for almost 8 months. The failed candidate, along with a few of his cohorts, issued several statements claiming that a great rigging had occurred in the election and it should be nullified, though they had not a single document or evidence for their claim. Thus, they fanned the flames of a street mutiny and called on gullible youth to pour to the streets and chant slogans against the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic system. In the heat of these events, Ayatollah Khamenei invited the youth and the people to be insightful and recognize the hidden hands of the enemies behind the curtains. Then US President Barack Obama used to send provocative messages to the simple-minded youth, calling the seditionist instigators as the Iranian nation. The enemy of the Iranian nation, the child killer regime in Tel Aviv, together with its comrades in crime in Europe, especially Britain, very soon declared their support for the insurgents. With the heated up provocation of the Western media and the direction of the domestic hypocrites, the issue of rigging in the election transferred into targeting the very Islamic system and its sacred ideals. The slogans changed so that instead of the deeply rooted slogan in support of Palestine and Lebanon, there could be heard slogans against the Islamic system, the leader, and the cause of Palestine and Quds from the rioters. This small group that was directly directed from overseas had indeed targeted the very identity of the Islamic system and the Islamic Revolution. As the sinister goals of the riots were revealed, the Iranian nation became aware of the plots of the enemies and understood that the sworn enemies had planned serious schemes for overthrowing the system and defeating the revolution. In addition, the leader of the Islamic Revolution did his best to awaken the rioters on the one hand and dissuade the heads of seditionists, the failed candidate and his accomplices, to return to the nation and repent for their grave sins. However, none of these people accepted the leader's fatherly advice and continued their seditionist remarks and moves. The climax of disrespect to the Islamic sanctities took place in the Islamic month of Muharram, particularly on the day of Ashura, when several morning gatherings and placards and mosques were set on fire to further lay bare the real face of the instigators and their masters. Therefore, the Iranian people lost their patience and stood against the seditionists and rioters in a very massive turnout. On the 30th of December 2009, just in Tehran, over 5 million people took to the streets to show their hatred towards disrespect of the Islamic sanctities and Imam Hussein, peace upon him. The nationwide turnout of the Iranian people on December 30, 2009 was purely for defending Islamic beliefs, the Islamic system, and the leader of the Islamic revolution. As a matter of fact, the progressive principle of velayat-e-faqih, or authority of supreme jurisprudence, which currently is manifested by the leadership of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, is the main pillar of the revolution. The Iranian people have many times seen that the Islamic revolution has moved through turbulent crises with the wise and prudent leadership of Imam Khomeini and Ayatollah Khamenei during over 4 decades of the revolution. They know it well that any measure to undermine the status of leadership is tantamount to undermining the authority of the infallible imams, and obedience of the leader is equal to obedience of God, the Prophet of Islam, and the infallible imams, blessings of God upon them. He is the guide towards sublimity and advancement within the framework of Islamic laws. The bond of the people with such a leader is an ideological bond which has its roots in their hearts. The rioters and their masters thought in vain that they could weaken this bond with rabble-rousing and obfuscating the climate. Quite opposite to what their wishful thinking, the Iranian people revised their allegiance with the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, and the ideals of the founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon his soul. On December of 2009, the Iranian nation proved that velvet revolutions will not work in Iran as long as they march in the footsteps of their leader. The color revolutions of Michael Ledin, Jane Sharp, and George Soros will not be effective in Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei said, "You saw that sedition was kicked up. Some works were done. Efforts were made. America defended the seditionist. Britain defended the seditionist. The Western powers, hypocrites, and kingdom seekers defend it." But what was the result? The result was that, against this magnitude of unblessed unity and convergence, our dear people, our great nation, on the 9th of day, on the 22nd of Bahman, demonstrated such a greatness that they bedazzled the world.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
From the day he started his presidential campaign, U.S. President Joe Biden told the world that America wants to go back to Iran's nuclear deal. From that day, Israel started to threaten the world that if the U.S. goes back to the deal, it would take matters into its own hands. So as the talks continued between Tehran and the P4+1 group of countries, Israel's voice of agony grows louder. Israel has launched a pressure campaign to make sure that the countries negotiating with Iran in Vienna do not agree to what Israeli officials call a bad deal, meaning a deal that allows Tehran to make nuclear bombs. The very idea of building a nuclear bomb is totally rejected by the Iranian government. In 2003, Iran's leader issued a fatwa that forbade the production and use of any form of weapon of mass destruction, which includes nuclear weapons. However, accusing Iran of going after the nukes is a strategy Israel uses to legitimize its hostile stance against Iran. The regime has even beefed up its military activities. In November, Israeli, Emirati, and Bahraini naval forces, for the first time, rehearsed joint security operations with a U.S. warship. A month earlier, Israel launched a war game at a desert airbase just north of the port city of Eilat, which sent fighter planes from the occupied territories and seven other countries roaring into the skies. Israel also allocated $1.5 billion to prepare the Israeli armed forces for a potential strike against Iran nuclear sites. In fact, there are near daily warnings from Israeli political and military officials as well. In the latest move in a series of threats, Israel's Minister of War Affairs ordered his forces to prepare a military option. Benny Gantz warned the world that Israel would take matters into its own hands if a nuclear agreement did not constrain Iran the way Israel wants it to.
Recently, the Chief of Staff, Aviv Kohavi, said that Israel is preparing to strike Iranian nuclear targets if needed. Are those preparations complete?
They will never complete. Before the only time of completing them will be the time that we will actually conduct them. Till then, we will continue to build them, to improve them. This is something that any military needs to do. We are working on it. We have them in our hands, of course, but we will continue and constantly improving them to the highest professional level possible. The Iranian nuclear aspiration must be stalled. If the world stops them before, it's very much good. But if not, we must stand independently and we must defend ourselves by ourselves.
What Gantz said could be interpreted as a direct threat. However, there are multiple military experts in and outside Israel who believe Gantz's statement was nothing but an empty threat. Several current and former senior Israeli military officials and experts say that Israel lacks the ability to attack Iran. Military experts say Tel Aviv can't pull off an assault that could destroy or even significantly delay Iran's nuclear program, at least not anytime soon. Now, one might ask why carrying out an assault on Iran would be impossible, given the fact that Israel has the latest military weaponry, fighter jets, and support of the United States. True, Israel has a long history when it comes to air attacks, but it won't be as easy as it was when it bombed Egypt, Gaza, Iraq, Lebanon, Sudan, Tunisia, and Syria. Not easy, at least, without potentially catastrophic consequences. To be sure, one could not compare Israel's bombing of such facilities in Iran to its air attacks against Iraq's Osirak reactor in 1981 or Syria's Al-Kubar facility in 2007. Relek Shafir, a retired Israeli Air Force general who was a pilot in a 1981 strike on an Iraqi nuclear facility, said, "Bombing Iran's nuclear facility is almost impossible." Iran has dozens of nuclear sites, some deep underground, that would be hard for Israeli bombs to quickly penetrate and destroy. The fact is, the Israeli Air Force does not have warplanes large enough to carry such large bombs, so the more protected sites would have to be struck repeatedly with less effective missiles, a process that might take days or even weeks. The other obstacle is geography. If Israel decides to carry out strikes on Iran, its warplanes must fly over 3,000 kilometers to get to Iran. This would cause fuel shortages as the planes have to fly the same amount to go back to Israel. Israel has already ordered jets that can make such flights at a cost of $2.4 billion, but the aircraft are back-ordered and Israel is unlikely to receive even one before late 2024. There's also the fear of retaliation. Naturally, if Iran gets attacked, it will respond vehemently. Some Israeli planes would almost certainly be lost during the sorties. Their pilots would be killed or taken prisoner, and such losses would have huge consequences for Israel. Let's not forget that Iran is a country of nearly 86 million people, with the potential ability to mobilize its networks all over the Middle East to retaliate. From Lebanon to Palestine and Syria, pro-Iranian forces surrounding Israel could make the regime pay a huge price for any attack. Israel's famous missile system is no good for such a confrontation either. The Iron Dome was never tested in a real battle. It only intercepted man-made Gazan rockets, not real missiles or rockets. It's not even capable of intercepting those handcrafted missiles coming from Gaza. So, if a war erupts, it is safe to say that the Iron Dome can't be much of a help to Israelis. In the meantime, Iran has a formidable missile arsenal of its own capable of precision strikes, which can easily respond to an Israeli bombing of its nuclear sites by going after softer targets.
They always shoot at Israel rockets, but in 2004 or 5, people start to get killed. Make me very annoyed that we don't have a solution. And also, I remember even 91, when Iraq shoot missiles in Israel, we have no solution. You know, everything was... Tel Aviv was empty. Okay. They shoot around Tel Aviv. And I decided that we have to do something. Although nothing had been done around the world and everybody said it cannot be done.
One doesn't need to be a general or a strategist to find out that the declarations by the Israeli officials about Israel's readiness for a military strike are empty and pointless rhetoric. All you need is to look at the past few decades. Since January 1995, Israel has been saying that Iran is much closer to producing nuclear weapons than previously thought and could be less than 5 years away from having an atomic bomb. 27 years later, Israel continues threatening to bomb Iranian nuclear facilities. And yet nothing, it's quite clear. Israel is just playing pretend.
In the limelight.
Omar Ashmawi, the staff director of the Office of Congressional Ethics, says lack of cooperation has not prevented his office's investigations from moving forward. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Luke Broadwater. The piece is titled Ethics Investigators in Congress Increasingly Run into Walls. Ethics investigators were examining four cases this fall detailing a sweeping array of improper financial conduct by lawmakers, they ran into an obstacle. Two of the lawmakers under scrutiny refused to meet with them or provide documents. The investigators were not too surprised. Over the past decade, fewer and fewer House of Representative members have been willing to cooperate with congressional investigations. A development that ethics experts warn could reduce accountability for misdeeds and erode trust in the institution of Congress. Omar Ashmawi, the staff director of the Office for Congressional Ethics, OCE, an independent entity that reviews allegations against House members and refers misconduct cases to the House Ethics Committee, acknowledged the growing resistance to his office's work, but said he was undeterred. It has never prevented us from being able to gather the facts and determine what happened and whether or not the subject was culpable. Still, the trend is unmistakable. In 2009 and 2010, the first Congress scrutinized by the Office of Congressional Ethics, which was created in 2008, three lawmakers refused to cooperate with the office's 68 investigations, a non-cooperation rate of just 4%. But this year, 6 out of 14 House lawmakers under investigation have refused to participate, a non-cooperation rate of 43%, the highest on record. Mr. Ashmawi said he believed the higher non-cooperation rate was a result of investigators focusing on fewer cases and more potentially serious ones. Lawmakers who may be glad to meet with ethics investigators to clear up an honest mistake or minor oversight are more reluctant to cooperate if they think they may face weightier consequences, he said. There is no requirement that lawmakers cooperate with the Office of Congressional Ethics, OCE, but legislators who do so often are able to resolve what had appeared to be violations of ethics rules. The fact that many will no longer even meet with ethics investigators reflects a troubling trend in American politics, in which improper behavior is no longer a political liability, ethics experts say. There's a trend towards not taking ethics rules seriously, and also more resistance to cooperating in ethics investigations, or frankly, even acknowledging the legitimacy or authority of ethics investigation, said Bryson Morgan, a lawyer at the firm Kaplan and Drysdale in Washington, who was previously an investigative counsel for the Office of Congressional Ethics. "I think there's been a bit of a backsliding on ethics," Bryson Morgan said. Morgan said he believed ethical norms changed during the Donald Trump era. As allegations piled up against former President Donald J. Trump with no apparent consequences, many politicians concluded that ethical behavior no longer mattered and decided to stop cooperating with congressional investigations, he said. "What people used to think was a career-ending mistake has been proven to not be a career-ending mistake," Bryson Morgan said. "Many people have noticed a shift in ethical norms. It used to be the case that when a member violated the ethics rules, if not a fine, there would be a fairly stiff political price to pay. I worry that has gone away." The two lawmakers who refused to cooperate in cases examined this fall were Representative Mike Kelly, a Republican of Pennsylvania, who is under scrutiny over stock purchases by his wife that investigators say were influenced by his actions as a member of Congress, and Representative Jim Hagedorn, Republican of Minnesota, whose office is accused of improperly awarding contracts to companies owned by his aide's relatives. Those cases now rest with the House Ethics Committee. A spokesman for Mr. Kelly did not respond to a request for comment. But Elliot Burke, an attorney for Mr. Hagedorn, said he was working directly with the Ethics Committee rather than the Office of Congressional Ethics to try to resolve the matter. Congressman Hagedorn will continue to work with the Ethics Committee to bring this matter to a conclusion, Mr. Burke said. Moreover, he had no knowledge of the underlying issues and has acted in good faith throughout. Congress rarely takes serious disciplinary steps against its own members unless their ethical misdeeds rise to a federal crime. The last House member expelled was James Traficant, a Democrat of Ohio, back in 2002, after he was convicted of 10 felony counts, including bribery, racketeering, and tax evasion. In 2020, the Senate Ethics Committee received 144 complaints of violations and dismissed them all. Kedrick Payne, the Senior Director for Ethics at the Campaign Legal Center and a former Deputy Chief Counsel for the Office of Congressional Ethics, said it was becoming all too common for lawmakers to flout the ethical rules Congress has imposed. The Campaign Legal Center has tracked dozens of violations of the Stock Act, which requires members to report stock trades within 45 days of the transaction, but is commonly ignored. Business Insider reported this month that 52 members of Congress violated the Act this year. Penalties are often minimal, beginning at just a $200 fine, and lawmakers are allowed a 30-day grace period to comply after missing the deadline. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat of California, recently dismissed the idea that members should be prohibited from trading stocks. "We're a free market economy," she told reporters. "They should be able to participate in that." But Kedrick Payne argued more needed to be done to ensure members of Congress were behaving ethically. Refusing to comply with the Stock Act or to cooperate with ethics investigations should not be accepted as routine, he said. Non-compliance with the Stock Act is the most blatant violation by multiple members of Congress that I've seen in recent history, he said. You need stronger rules that would restrict stock trades that appear to be conflicts of interest, for example, trading stock in an industry that is within the jurisdiction of your committee. Still, he believes participating with a congressional investigation is likely the smartest strategy for a lawmaker. In 2019, Representative David Schweikert, Republican of Arizona, refused to cooperate with an Office of Congressional Ethics (OCE) investigation into campaign finance violations and allegations that he misused funds and pressured his congressional staff to perform campaign work. He later became the first member reprimanded on the House floor since 2012. If you don't cooperate, there's a higher likelihood that the Office of Congressional Ethics will find substantial reason to believe that a violation occurred, Kedrick Payne said.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. We are here with the program The Muslim Lady. I'm Farman Ali Masumi, and with me in the studio,
Raziatul Najafi, Alhamdulillah. Again, Allah has given us this great opportunity. I'm so glad and thankful to Allah.
Alhamdulillah. So we were discussing the very interesting and important topic about female, our Muslim lady. So in our previous episode, we talked about the Imam Khomeini's viewpoint about Muslim lady. So today we are also continuing the same topic.
Okay, before our listeners, inshallah, they will stay with us. And I really want them to stay with us. Therefore, I'm emphasizing a lot that this topic is not an ordinary topic. This is very important. You know why? Because, inshallah, we are going to recite one Surah Fatiha, definitely, and few salawat for soul of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, because he has given us so many rights back from this beautiful Islamic rights from this cruel world, because they have just stolen out our status and our rights.
Because of him, we are keeping our heads high in front of the Western world,
no doubt, indeed.
And in front of the Muslim societies, especially, you know, in the Middle East, in the other...
Exactly. Salutes to him, definitely. Salutes to him.
So we are talking about the importance of a mother's role in the viewpoint of Imam Khomeini, Rizwanullah Ta'ala Alayhi. You know, although Imam Khomeini has encouraged women to play a role in the society, in politics, in all aspects of life, but he has stressed and emphasized more about the role of a mother. You know, he says when a mother is, you know, practicing real Islam and he is following the rules of Islam, definitely she will bring very good children, which means we will have a very good society. So in one of the quotations, he says, the lapse of a mother is the biggest school for a child. You know, this means that our children can learn the basic and the most important things of their life from the laps of their mother. It means our mother should you know, be a very good practicing Muslim lady. The initial institution and school of all the children is the laps of their mother. Like we learn so many things from school, you know, the all important things which play a very vital and important role in our life, we learn from the school. So Imam Khomeini says, really the Islam's idea that all the children, they have the basic and important institute in the form of a mother. So if they face, if they have a very good and healthy environment in their initial and in their first school, definitely it will play a very big and vital role in their life, in exactly. their society. Dear listeners, we will take a very short break. Inshallah, we'll come back soon.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are talking about the role of women in the viewpoint of Imam Khomeini, Ridwanullah Ta'ala Ali.
I love this quotation of Imam Khomeini that he says, "O mothers, you have to achieve and you have to learn all the virtues, all the good deeds. You know, you have to be the center of khair, faza'il. Why? Because if you are the center of